and part of the St. Olaf connection. Taught there for 30 years, and I enjoy hearing about children, grandchildren, nephews, nieces, grandparents, and the like who have been there. I try not to overdo this because I didn't attend St. Olaf myself. I went to Concordia Moorhead and have to get in a pitch for that. And the two things that I want to mention that are sort of just practical necessity, neither to complain nor do anything but clarify. I have low vision, and that is my ready-made excuse for not identifying people that I should know, particularly if they are more than 6 feet away from me. I went up on the hill to find out what time it was, and I discovered one of my problems was that I had been trying to read time from the thermometer out on but I found a clock, and I think I got set. The second thing is, and you might think I should have retired a good deal longer ago than last spring, I also have a low hearing. I wear a hearing aid, and if we get some responses, I hope we shall, I ask you to play fair with me and others too in simply speaking up. I used to think my dad was really not with it when he began to talk about all these young people who mumbled so. Now, I've had these students and they're mumbling all the time. I can't understand them. Now, the other side of that is that I will tend to speak loud enough so that those of you who either have or should have or would like to have or will have hearing aids can hear me too. If you don't hear me, stand up and rattle something. We're here to begin a series. I am booked for 3 weeks at Holden this time and have a 10-day sequence set out, which I was informed very few would see through beginning to end, and that's fine. You are excused if you come back late from going up to the farthest lake and get late in for everything. And if there's something else that you want to hear because you're here for a short time and want to sample as much as you can, that's fine too. I do not take roll, I do not give a final grade, and that too is one of the blessings. I will not have to give final examinations and give grades any longer. Funny thing, they never complain about getting grades too high. The other way is always the way it goes. So, what am I going to do the third week? Well, I shall have a series of five sort of excerpted from the 10 of this week and next. And to give you some more arithmetic, I am transposing to our setting here a term course that I have done at St. Olaf for hundreds of young people who certainly could not appreciate this as much as you can. I'm not saying it's going to be a better course, but we're talking about people's lives. And you people have had so much more life. You've lived so much more. You respond to so many more different situations than the 20 to 22-year-olds. I don't put them down. They responded well. I feel sort of like the preacher who was called in to hold a service in a penitentiary and was very nervous about it because he had never before faced a prison audience, and he wanted to find something that could touch everybody out there. So his opening gambit was, how many of you had mothers? Well, my opening question to you that I've already answered is, how many of you have a biography? Now, not written, but you've all got one. Some of you might even have, and I would commend you if you do, an autobiography, one that you have written out in some way, or failing a formal, I was born on a cold and wintry night, and bring it up to the present. You might have a journal or a diary that you have kept with some regularity. Or if you follow my tactic, you may have a file folder or a box, a shoebox will do, in which you have tucked things that pertain to your life. This is, to coin a phrase, this is your life. We are going to be talking, however, about some figures who were notable and who wrote some kind of an autobiography that has weathered a good deal of testing, has inspired people, and I think has had the quality also of having people say, I have thought that way, I have felt that way, I have known that kind of a hurt, I have suffered. We have related to these people. Actually, I'm dealing with three out of the seven textbooks that I would normally use, and even so, we're going to be just sort of bouncing along like somebody tumbling down a steep hiking path. I hope you don't do it. Hitting some high points. And I have announced before, the authors that I shall be dealing with are C.S. Lewis, whose book Surprised by Joy we'll begin with, Ayako Miura, Japanese contemporary woman, poet, and fiction writer, who tells the story of her conversion from a nominal Buddhism to the Christian faith, and the well-known former Secretary General of the UN, Dag Hammarskjöld, whose book Markings has survived for a long time. There was initial spurt, I think probably it was a Book of the Month club, it sold widely, it was much talked about, and now it is available in the inevitable indication of some kind of classic hard survival character in a paperback. The general title is God and Faith in Autobiography. This is a new type of approach that we are doing, not only at St. Olaf, but in other colleges, so there is some kind of interchange. You expect us in the colleges to teach biblical studies, and we do. You expect us to teach doctrinal studies, and we do, and ethics, and world religions, and meeting social issues, women's studies now, the range is broadening. To talk about theology in terms of autobiography seems to be a kind of watering down. Tom used the phrase this afternoon about this African people, doing theology. This is a phrase that we use a good deal, I think, in all our courses. Again, it sounds like some kind of a catchphrase, to do theology. Don't you learn it? Don't you study it? Don't you accept it? What is this business of doing theology? I've never favored the kind of sort of self-praising statement that I have heard people in the college religion area use when they talk contemptuously of Sunday school religion. I think Sunday school and confirmation class does a tremendous task in nurturing the faith. And I think increasingly it has been, particularly in confirmation class, its own way of doing theology. I learned, wasn't it 388 questions in the explanation by heart? plus the catechism. I was never forced to learn the Bible history, as I was told another generation of them. That was learning theology, and I still hark back to a lot of those phrases. They have become a part of my doing. But the challenge in reading the autobiographies of Christian people is for the student, the reader, the hearer of lectures, to engage and to make the kind of sense of this experience that is doing theology. Now, it means, of course, that there is not a tidy sequence. We do not find a way to find to get a text that starts out with a doctrine of creation and goes on to redemption, follows the creed. Rather, and we usually place a course like this where there has been some introduction at the college level to Christian teachings, biblical studies and so on, one discovers that this person is now writing about human nature, saying something about the state of our fallen humanity in a concrete way. And again, as Ralph said this morning in dealing with Genesis, this is a concrete statement about the creation. These are concrete statements about the believing people, about how they interacted with the faith, how they grew in it, how they came to see new dimensions and perspectives and meet new challenges. And as we follow along then in these writings, our task is also to engage so that we on our very level of our approach are also doing theology. That doesn't say that the stories are not fascinating, but they are not stereotypes. They are not people saying the same, and then, and then, and then, and then. You read another one, it's and then, and then, and then, and then. They are different people. C.S. Lewis will tell in Surprised by Joy. Incidentally, the three books are available for the curious, those who are excited enough, who want to pick up one or the other of them, in the little bookstore here. Lewis is best known as not only the writer of children's fiction, but the writer of serious Christian fiction for adults, has dealt with a lot of burning issues, a book on miracles, one on the Psalms, dealing with some of the hard Psalms that we very seldom hear dealt with. You know, even in the LBW, you will find that some of the Psalms that pose some problems for us in our context are just not given there. They're not worshipful. I'm not sure, but I'd rather think that the psalm that says, "Blessed is he who dashes the children of our enemies' heads against stone." Huh? The people of God talking like that, crying down damnation on innocent children, it's there. And you have to commend somebody like Lewis out of his concern for kind of problems that Christian people are meeting. They not only say, well, how are we going to put miracles into the contemporary worldview? They said, how are we going to keep the Psalms in the midst of the contemporary worldview? In addition to that, however, what is less well known and doesn't seem to be even in place in talking within the Christian community, Lewis was a profound scholar of English language and literature, and some of the work that he did there is still being used as solid text in rather obscure areas like medieval literature. Here is a figure, the kind, of course, that sometimes we like to scalp and wave and say, here is a Christian. See, an honored man taught at Oxford and Cambridge until he was a Christian. I don't want to do that kind of thing. But what we are looking for in these autobiographies is the reflective competence of people who do ask questions and who do not come to a simplistic faith. Because they're the ones that can help us. Particularly when our faith is tried and the simple answer is not getting at the agony of our faith's test. Does it do the final thing for grief when somebody says, yes, but your loved one will live again? Does that meet the day-to-day anguish of the empty place, the shattered futures? One of our senior women students committed suicide last spring. There were wrestlings in her that people didn't sense. She took a time when she was staying at home to do her practice teaching, and her family was away, to go into the family car. She had written her last entry in her journal. She had her Bible there. The car was in the garage with the door closed, and she let the motor run. Now, what kind of an answer that is not stupid, unfeeling, do you bring to somebody like that? This is said not just to make sort of special anguish, but to see that we need also, as we hear about these people who were not perfect Christians, that they knew trials, testings, tribulations. Somebody who knew C.S. Lewis very well said he was a very good man who had a hard time at it. Now that's our kind of fellow. All right. That's something of background and probably too intensely and unnecessarily emotional. Another problem, of course, just from the kind of material we're dealing with and the way we approach it, and I've used it in the heading for this evening, and that is something on experience, the worth of experience. Now, this too does not seem to fit the ordinary pattern for doing theology. Shouldn't theology be virtually exclusively out of the scripture, and then with the church fathers and the confessions? What about this I-ness? This, I was born on a cold and wintry night, and I went through this and that experience. Is that properly within our Christian concerns? Well, let's put that one down right away. I mentioned the Psalms, and some of the better known ones are the I Psalms. Psalm 8. O Lord, our sovereign, how glorious is thy name in all the earth. Thy majesty is praised high as the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes, of infants at the breast, thou hast rebuked the mighty, silencing enmity and vengeance to teach thy foes a lesson. When I look up at thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars set in their place by thee, what is man that thou shouldest remember him, mortal man that thou shouldest care for him? Yet thou hast made him little less than a god, crowning him with glory and honor. The psalmist is saying to him, the lesson of creation is that he is God's creation. When I look up, and we see the majesty here, it's not just a matter of saying the greatness of God, But again, as Ralph mentioned this morning, it speaks to our createdness. That is doing theology and listening to the voice of experience. Well, here's another one, and this is more familiar. From Psalm 32, let me go down to verse 3. When I refused to speak, my body wasted away with moaning all day long, for day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. The sap in me dried up as in a summer drought. Then I declared my sin. I did not conceal my guilt. I said, with sorrow I will confess my disobedience. So every faithful heart shall pray to thee. Again, it is the simple, but I think not simplistic, confession of the troubled sinner who has known the anguish of a very bad conscience, has confessed and knows again the goodness of forgiveness. And again, very similar to our Psalm 8, Psalm 121, if I lift up my eyes to the hills, where shall I find help? Help comes only from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. How could he let your foot stumble? How could he, your guardian, sleep? Isn't that exactly what Elmer Witt was telling us last evening? And I was grateful, because I think we are badly served if we do not oftener hear about the providence of God. Sure, we go along and we are comfortable and blessed in so many ways. We wouldn't be here if we weren't modestly blessed. At the same time, as was pointed out, not falsely, there are all those uncertainties. The kinds of things that the politicos like to make hay of. It gets to be a question of which of the candidates is going to relieve you most of worry. And you know down in your heart that not one of them is really going to get the solution. And they better keep our Social Security coming, or we're all in trouble. Down the way. And of course, there's a way of doing it that puts it on my children and yours and my grandchildren. And I think it's something that needs to be answered not just out of the empty promises of leaders and the manipulators, to come back again to that affirmation we heard last evening so marvelously put. Now that's experience. That's experience that is teaching us. Why are we sort of afraid of it? It doesn't have to be divorced from Scripture, as we see. We can go to Paul and find him saying very candidly, describing his spiritual condition, where he comes to the point and says, I am the worst of sinners. What does that have to say? Not something to enhance the gospel that for the worst of sinners there was the greatest of mercy. And I have turned very often to 2 Corinthians and to the reassurance that comes from Paul's word, when he can say that when we are weakest, then God shows himself as the strongest. That too is experience. When we have the records, of course, as we do in the autobiographies, we have some misgivings. Of course, we say, well, that's how one person felt. That's subjective. And one of the greatest polarities that I see in our modern world is that we have subjectivity ranged over against objectivity. And again, without setting these two beasts roaring at each other, the objective view, the dispassionate observer view, seems to be the one that we are encouraged to listen to the most, whether it is in how we teach people or how we help the emotionally disturbed or how we deal even with the physical problems. And there are those who believe you can detach yourselves from them. I was talking with Don Ring just casually a while ago about the problem we heard about at supper, about why there is concern about the hydroelectric power for Holden. There is another stream that has plenty of water all year round. There is authorization for it. There will, of course, have to be money. But there has been a suit instigated by some group that wants to protect the environment, or something like that. And a dam on that railroad creek, is it, would be offensive to some people. Now, it isn't that people are against Holden Village, but there are people who say that, well, they don't need this. There's plenty of power where they come from, and one more dam is just going to be one more nuisance. And yet they would proudly say, well, now this is objective. We don't want any more dams. Frankly, I don't want as many interstates as I enjoy riding on, but I wouldn't want to surrender them, and I wouldn't go back to some of the highways that I traversed across the mountains back 30 or 40 years ago. I love them. I hate the sort of desecration of such areas. But I know on the other side, you see, I'm saying, no, don't stop it now. Don't close the highway. Don't turn off the power. I am subjective about these things. I was subjective a while ago when I said, keep the Social Security coming. We vote subjectively. And that's of course, the reason we distrust statements that are made out of experience. We know, of course, these books are largely written out of things recalled. Some of them were written from journals, not because at the age of 9 somebody said, I'm going to be a very important person, I better keep record of every important thing I do, so I can write my life story, but because it interested them. Then when they came to write, they had something to refer to. Interestingly, C.S. Lewis didn't believe in diaries. I scanned a little bit of his brother's diary, in which Lewis is very much involved. It's in a book called Friends and Brothers. And Lewis wasn't above reading his brother's diary, with permission. Somebody else did it, it was okay, but he just didn't keep one. So he's depending on memory. One of the things that Lewis tells us about is when he went off as a little kid with his older brother to an English boarding school. And your heart just goes out, you know. They go on this boat across, they were living in Ireland, go across the Irish Sea and go to England, and they find their way to the train. The older brother knows his way, and they meet friends along the way, and they end up at this school. One was a simply horrible place with a headmaster who was a real sadistic type. And Lewis, as young and sensitive as he was, just shriveled under this. He writes about this in very harsh terms. He doesn't give the name precisely in the book of the headmaster who was guilty of this, but people who figure it out, well, they know where he went. And some of that man's family said that Lewis was too harsh on him. And some of the people who were there with Lewis said, well, you know, we were at school with him. He seemed to be a happy boy. He didn't always go around moaning and groaning the way he does in his book. We worry about this when people come to write their memoirs. How honest is their report? How well did they remember? Well, they may miss some things, but by and large, you have to hand it to the person examining his or her own life that they know better how they felt and how they feel about this. It might be something that has bothered you for years, and somebody says, well, now, that shouldn't bother you. You're not the kind of person who lets that bother you, are you? Say, I am. I know it. I know things about myself that no one else does. If I've chosen to write it here, it's because I felt it was necessary. Hammarskjöld, in what became the preface for Markings, made this statement, and again, the person who wrote the introduction said, well, now, Hammarskjöld is extreme in that. He said, I know myself better than others. Now, that isn't always true. We're not arguing for the absolute perfection of memory or of insight, but we don't want to ignore this. How we see ourselves is important. That girl that I mentioned, only afterward those who were close to her say, there were clues that I should have seen. And one of Well, there's a former student of mine that I happened to meet some weeks before this, and she told with joy and pride of her daughter at St. Olaf. She wasn't the kind who was pushing her to the point where she would become suicidal. She didn't know. And there are all these secrets that we are entertaining. Some of them can be destructive, some of them are just there, but we know it. The buck stops with us and our responsibility. And I think each of these writers comes up with the same realization. Thank God they're not saying, my life was spoiled by a miserable home. Or those teachers, how could I ever become anything with teachers like that? The kind of thing where one's environment becomes the scapegoat for anything that goes wrong. No, I think it is a very Christian view that says, this is my life. And the changes that came about in it, I was active in working. The buck stopped with me. I can't complain that I was tested. The scripture says, you're not tested above what you are able. Now, what kinds of experience? I've suggested some things here. You see how I can sort of wade through and get on and then dig around here and find a little sheet of paper that's smaller than the rest. Well, I really got this. See, I'm watching the time, too, and my instruction said, these people want to talk, and I grant you've got it right. What kinds of experience, without having read these books, would you see as critical to the spiritual development, the kinds of things that they look back on later as giving them the material for their reflection? I mentioned one, give you that free, and that is, of course, education. Public education, there's more to be elaborated on there. We might want to say something more about that. What are some of the other areas that we know are sensitive in our spiritual autobiography? I could have you chattering two and three together, but I think we'll short-circuit that and get at some of these other things.
Our heritage, some of the people we've met and know.
Okay. Some of the people we've met and know, friends. I mentioned teachers. There is an interesting brief segment in Surprised by Joy in which Lewis tells about his experience in the trenches in the First World War. He was actually wounded and sent home, invalided out. But he doesn't make a great deal of that in his account here. He doesn't say it was really great or it was fun. It wasn't. You know, the trenches and what they were like, rat-ridden and full of water. And the British, after all, were there long before the Americans came. Amazingly, he did very well. Coming from upper middle class, and certainly more than upper middle class education fitting in, had some friends there and speaks very highly of some of the non-coms and their strength. It's a very important part. I guess I give him credit for not leaning on this too much, because it was years after that trench experience that he really came to faith. He was hard-nosed enough, so even his faithlessness could carry him through that. What else? What other areas might be? Yes?
Illness.
And here you have his injury, which he takes in stride. Illness will be a factor very much in Ayako Miura's story. A long, long siege, and because I know some of you aren't going to be here, and besides that, it's sort of easier to weave and show you some of the pattern coming. I can tell you Aoka Miura was a teacher in Japan during the Second World War. She was very young. She was teaching grade school children. It's almost reminiscent of the time when you didn't even have to have a full high school education before you could go out and teach country school. But she was a good teacher. She loved her children. And when Japan was defeated, she was set to the task by the occupying American forces of having her children take their school books. They couldn't afford new ones. But they took their erasers and, under the direction of the victors, were told, "This you no longer can teach. This does not fit in with our view of life." So here she is. She's been teaching these things until abruptly she said, "You can't teach that. Cross it out. Can't teach that. Cross it out." The whole value system was upset. She quit teaching, and shortly after that developed tuberculosis. And in the post-war years, she was very sick. The care was absolutely horrible. Family was expected to bring food in, and patients took care of one another as much as they could. And for a long, long time, she was at home in a cast, body cast, because of tuberculosis of the spine. That's one thing, and it's a factor. I find that, not because my students have been so well, can't really conceive of illness, very few of them even hit a hospital yet since they were born, but I think they realize that Aoko's story too sort of minimizes that for the internal things, but it's a factor. I know. I probably inject when I don't need to the fact that I've suffered low vision. It's been 20 years, and that gave me quite a few years before. But I can count up how many eye operations I had and the uncertainty. You're in a field where you're dependent on your eyes, and then you go with this array of visual aids and you still don't see well. So physical disabilities, physical illness, problem. What does it do? Depends on who you are, what you make of it. Something else. I saw another hand here. Yes?
I don't think that all of those things have to be negative. I think good health and prosperity can be a real factor in life. Very positive.
Okay. I think here, again jumping ahead, you see in the case of Aoko, or not Aoko, she wasn't Secretary General. Doug Hammarskjöld. How can I mix up Hammarskjöld and Miura? Secretary General of the United Nations. Accepting this position, and he came from a very prestigious Swedish family, there are personal issues we see there, sort of his self-image and what he's doing. But it's a different kind of a context that plays in. It didn't spoil him, still leave some of the questions unanswered. You had a hand.
When you were talking about journals and that sort of thing, I just had a flashback, and some week or two ago before we came up here, I was looking for something special in amongst the books, and I ran into a paper that I'd written 20-some years ago when I was taking a class, and this was a kind of a self-analysis thing. And I hadn't seen it for years, and I was truly interested in the insight that I had at that time. I had suffered the loss of my husband at that time, and it was just full of the way I was feeling at that time and the growing, and how I grew out of the grief episode in the growing period.
That's marvelous, and I'm glad for the specific character. And incidentally, C.S. Lewis's little book, which he wrote after the death of his wife. He was an older man, up in his 50s when he was married, and we'll probably talk about that a little later. And he wrote A Grief Observed, and there are a few copies of that over in the bookstore that's well worth reading. I've read a lot of the autobiographical grief stories, because I lost my first wife less than 2 years ago and married again to a widow. we know grief. And I've heard so many people say they were writing all the way through, writing about this. And this was a tremendous aid in working through, coming to some understanding. I guess one of the reasons that I like this area, and one of the reasons that I play fast and loose with it too, is that along with this, with my students usually, I have them do some journal writing. With the deal, I will not ask you to turn in your journals so I can...
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a good one.
But I want them to have the experience. How do I check it? Got to get those grades. Say, give me a report showing that you wrote and writing just, the things that you could tell anybody. Once in a while, I have a student who says, you can read the whole thing. It's okay. Back of these autobiographical works, in some cases, there may not be a diary in Lewis's case, but there can be, I would say, an internal journal. Nice phrase. An internal journal. There's been a dialogue that belongs there. I'm sure you were doing some sort of talking to yourself. Every so often, and when we get these close-ups, some of you people are probably golfers here, and you see a man miss a 4-foot putt, and he turns away, and I say he's talking to himself. Or the end misses a pass that, as they say, was in a bad spot, it was right in his hands. But I encourage this. If you want to talk about it, and incidentally, I'll be around and get within a 6-foot range, and I'll know that you want to talk to me, and some odd hours we can talk about this, because I've tried to espouse this. There are some handbooks about journal writing. I started my hand at it, and I guess that's been my fate, started and quit. But I've got some old papers. I've got some old journals. I've got some things I've written. I've got some poetry. I won't read that to you. I haven't got it long, thank God. But here, this dialogue, very private. God knows. Very helpful. You might say, well, I can pray. Yes, that's the same thing. Only it should have some kind of a back and forth. Not just because you want to play God and God's answer, but sometimes we have to say, oh, I say that, but I'm kidding myself. Or I'm taking this position, but that's not really honest. And the dialogue that you can do there is, I think, a very creative thing. And particularly also to have something that you can return to and read after the space of some days or weeks or even years. And I think you'll amaze yourself. I don't mean this in any nasty way, at how clever you really are. The things you really see. We put ourselves down very often. We say, why? I couldn't do anything like Lewis. I could put in it. Well, the form might be lacking, but the potential is there. Because of the faith delivered to the saint, because of Sunday school, confirmation, sermons, conversations with friends, all this. But sometimes it just needs to be made a little bit more exact and be put down so you can look at it. And then put down in the lower drawer where nobody would get at it and pull it out to look at it. I'd be happy to talk some more about just doing journal. And the beauty of it is, it's not a diary. There's not one of those pesky books that challenges you, because every day you've got 16 lines. And some days you only had 2 lines worth, and some days you didn't have anything, and you get a sense of guilt. Beautiful thing about a journal is you can do it now, again, and then come back. Yes?
I think it's interesting that you mentioned sermons at this point in time. And yet, as you asked, anything that has affected our life, not one of us spoke of sermons as having affected our life.
Not yet. We should go some more. I've got some more, had some more hands I ignored here. Some of you were unfortunately in the shadows.
Don't forget family.
No. Right. And here too, since I'm sort of reading from memory some of the things here, there are these two elements. Well, Lewis had a father and a mother. His mother died when he was very young. And Lewis describes this experience he had as a small boy. His mother was very sick. They said she was dying. And so he prayed God to save his mother. And she died. In retrospect, he records both. He's sort of, okay, supposed to be able to pray and God will answer. I prayed, he didn't. Forget it. But in retrospect also, he said, I saw God as a magician. He was supposed to pull things out of the hat. I think that's probably why he comes back. There, I noticed another book. Incidentally, there are quite a few books in the circulating library here at Lewis's, and one is Letters to Malcolm, primarily about prayer. He knew that was a problem. His father was a strange fellow. The children went to church, like that. And that, of course, seems to be the worst possible thing. In fact, Lewis could say, you know, he was confirmed at a time when he didn't believe, but was under compulsion, really felt guilty about it. And for a long time, he was way away from the church. He will say candidly, and he was more than just a kind of showplace atheist. So he'll tell in the introduction, this is the story of his movement from atheism to Christianity by a series of stages. His father wanted his sons to go to church. His father's interest was not the most evangelical. He loved oratory. He loved sort of rolling phrases. He could love a sermon that just sort of spellbinding. He loved to read the great orators of that time that we don't really have now, and we've come down to simple statements and clear statements, and no one is supposed to embellish a sermon. But there was this also. His father loved the style. The old King James. Now that's bad too. You heard the difference. You saw the difference. I was reading from the New English Bible, and the translation is different. I confess I still, in many cases, prefer the poetry, the 23rd Psalm in the King James Version. In fact, I still find the Lord's Prayer, if not in the excellent Norwegian, at least in the almost as excellent Old English fashion. Our Father who art in heaven. So you have a kind of form carried over here in religious affairs through the Father, without the content really being very important. And yet you find in Warren's diaries, that's the older brother of Lewis, and in Lewis's attitude, that something by osmosis got through to them, something of the grandeur here. And it just lay there for a long, long time. And then it comes back again with a new verb and fervor. But it's been implanted in the family. Unfortunately, there was a real sliding past one another. The father really didn't look at himself. The boys would be home for vacation, this is an example, and you say, now boys, what do you want to do? You're home, you're on holiday, whatever you want, we shall do it. So the boys would suggest the things that they would do. And the father would say, fine, and completely ignore what they wanted and do what he intended to do all the time. They had a hard time with him, and there was a certain amount of bitterness there. They made their duty visits. But somehow I think, too, the memory of a sweet and gentle mother who died so tragically young was a factor in Lewis's development. And there is an interesting touch in Hammarskjöld that I like to work with. And since that's for next week and not too many will be here, let me tell you about it now. I don't have my text along. Hammarskjöld basically has a journal. It's very erratic. The editors had to try to give dates to it. It was sequential, but they had to try to figure out what year and what the circumstances were. But there were some firm points, and those were New Year's. And Hammarskjöld would write there, "Now the day is over, night is drawing nigh." The editor's footnote said, "This came from a hymn that Dag's mother read to the family on New Year's Eve, year after year after year." And when Hammarskjöld, too, was saying, "I consider it to be absolutely hopeless that I can find meaning in life." Now, you may not say it's atheism, it's probably almost worse. It's a nothingness. But at New Year's, and he was probably sitting alone in his apartment in New York, that hymn came. I've had trouble with that, and I've done a little work on it, and I'll be saying more down the line a long way. The hymn is not the old familiar hymn some of us know from the beautiful black hymn, the Lutheran hymnary, "Now the day is over, night is drawing nigh, time to go to church." I might sing it. But it's a hymn that I ferreted out in a Swedish hymn book. That's the most marvelous thing. It's not just saying, "We've had a wonderful day, now we're going to go to a quiet, blessed worship experience," but it was looking at life and saying, "Soon death is going to come. But our shepherd, the Lord Jesus Christ, is promising us life. And so we can look on to the year that is coming and the life that is coming because of our faith in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd who died for us." And I am convinced that that is what came back to bless those New Year experiences of Hammarskjöld from his mother and their family devotions. Thank you.